I'm delighted now to welcome poet Anne Valley Fox. Her new book is called How Shadows Are Bundled, published by University of New Mexico Press, and she will be speaking this Sunday, November 29th, at Acequia Booksellers on 4th Street in Albuquerque. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So your new book, How Shadows Are Bundled, I was thinking about the title, and you're starting with a paradox. Shadows being something you can't control, and bundling is an action that you do to something that you can't bundle.
That's exactly right. I hadn't thought of it, of course, myself. It's actually the title of one of the poems, and I think why it's the title of the book is that a lot of the poems are portraits of light and shadow.
Light and shadow, in very much of a metaphorical.
Yes.
Yeah.
In individuals and in the collective psyche.
Why don't we start with reading one of the poems?
Love to. I'm going to start with one that imagines the arc of a woman's relationship to sexual power. And its original title was Promiscuity. It's called Catch and Release. Once out of the closet, an actual cranny, stale suits and dangling necktie nooses. It wasn't the custard embrace of women she wanted. No, it was men in their beautiful bodies, their minds like mineral quarries, wistful and reckless and crude. She knew how to cross a room and make them want her. The Rolling Stone, the family man pinned by Lilliputians, the spiritual master witching fissures. It wasn't salvation but clout she was after. Like generals plotting foreign wars, she'd bully the natives into submission and leave them. Once a stranger scooped her out of a green hole. She lay in his hands, swollen and gold as a carp. That time, she trembled before she leapt. If downstream another fisher could catch her, it was because she would let him. Sometimes she played at catch and release, but twice hooked, she'd flip back into the river, drifting dark down the dark caves of the current. Beached one day in the brown waters of Matamoros, she knelt and kissed the ground. Her children like pea plants climbing into the blue, she lay down and the earth curved to hold her.
I'm glad you didn't call it promiscuity.
A little obvious, isn't it? Or too limiting, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a kind of a polarization that people make between a kind of puritanical goodness on the one hand and promiscuity on the other hand.
Right.
Whereas sexuality,
right,
in its beauty and fullness, can't be contained by either of those things.
That's beautiful. It's true. It's true. Promiscuity would be a judgment that someone from the outside would make. Although, in this particular psychic portrait, which I think it is, the woman being described has some of that judgment against herself. That's kind of important in the poem, too.
I think also, listening to that poem and reading some of the other poems, it strikes me that talking about gender and sexuality sometimes are better done through a poetic medium than through the direct bright light of psychology studies or something like that.
I know. There's this quote that I love by Osip Mandelstam, and he said, if a poem can be translated, in which case he means interpreted, if a poem can be translated, the sheets aren't rumpled, poetry hasn't spent the night. So, you know, we got to work these things over and toss and turn, and it's all complicated.
I guess by translated or interpreted, if you can say it better in another way, then the poem isn't doing its job.
Absolutely.
Very interesting. And it's tricky, too, because sometimes I'll read a poem, some of your poems included, and say, what is this about? What does this mean?
And of course, the answer is they're not about anything. They're like meteors or forces of energy or force fields. A poem, you'll notice that a poem is understood is felt before it's ever understood, if it is ever understood.
I guess so. Although, I mean, you have a sonnet to your mailman. It's kind of about your mailman. It's kind of about you.
True. That's true. they are sometimes about something, but I just don't want to be held accountable for them, you know, being attached to an actual experience, because sometimes they are and sometimes they're not, and sometimes it's, most often it's a mix.
In poetry, you use some of the tools of fiction. Some of the poems are maybe a little bit more like prose. Some of them are made up. They're fictional characters moving through these poems. Mm-hmm. What's the line between prose and poetry?
I think that my poems have characters in them, and they have stories in them. But it's my I feel that my job is a gestalt to convey a feeling level, maybe an intuitive sense of what something's about. My job is not to tell a story from the beginning to end, or to justify why a character makes a move or doesn't. Poems are shorter than novels, which is a wonderful aspect for somebody who's... when I first started writing, I liked writing poems because I could fit them into a little space. In fact, they go on and on. It takes me a long time to really finish a poem, but it's sort of a snap, sort of a gestalt, and that fits my personality better than being it, the task, which I've never tried and I know I could never do, of telling a story from beginning to end in 350 pages and 5 years later, you know, drawing a sigh of relief.
Right. Although there is a genre of very, very short fiction, which are almost, I don't know what the difference is really between that kind of sudden fiction, mm-hmm. half a page story on the one hand, and one of your prose poems on the other.
Prose poems, they kind of bridge the gap between poetry and prose. And I adore prose poems. I like to write them, and I really like to read a good one. Because and it's hard to say what, for your listeners, I mean, a prose poem is where it looks like a paragraph rather than broken lines of various lengths, so that you have the right margin is justified rather than ragged.
To what extent do you work with traditional forms, sonnet, haiku? There are some of these, rhyme, not so much.
I've played with them all, but I don't tend to just naturally go there. So I'm just listening for the music inside myself. And as soon as I can find the beginning of a melody, I'm off and running. And then the poem tells you what its shape wants to be.
Right.
Uh-huh. Once you get it rolling.
We're talking to poet Anne Valley Fox. Her new book is called How Shadows Are Bundled. Would you like to read another poem?
I'd love to. So this book has two parts. One is portraits of individuals, imaginary or real or something in between. And the second part is about the collective unconscious. And I'd like to read a couple more maybe from the individual. So this is a portrait of, it attempts to describe a man who wants out and makes a sudden break for it. And I'm trying to describe why and how he does this. The man in the mirror. I wake in a room on the fourth floor, iron balcony, April light, and stand in the bathroom looking into the mirror. My body has blown apart in the night like a pile of sand. Livid with loathing, I pack my bag, quit the hotel, and hail a cab for the airport. At home, I regretfully tell my wife, I no longer love you, I'm leaving. How can it be that the more she weeps, the more my flesh firms in the morning mirror?
That's pretty heavy.
It is. And there's a big story there, and it's whittled down to about 10 lines.
Now, is that a story that, on some level, was inspired by something that you saw or experienced in some way?
That one was. I, you know, saw a man leave his wife summarily after a long relationship, just very suddenly, and it was a shock, of course, to her and to all their friends. And I have another poem in the book, in fact, called "Notes to a Man Who's Thinking of Leaving His Wife," and I'm trying to rationalize with him, and I can't find a single real reason to say don't go, other than it hurts, you know. But anyway, I was looking at this particular person and thinking, trying to imagine what would be going on in a person that he would suddenly need to change his life in that way. So I imagined this scenario of the mirror in the hotel.
Very interesting. There's a film that's screening next week in the Santa Fe Film Festival called Character, and it's about how actors play different characters. And one of the actors in the film, it's a documentary, said most actors are liberal rather than conservative. And the reason for that is when you're an actor, you have to walk in other people's shoes. And when you do that, you're no longer able to judge them so harshly.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that you would have the same experience in, for example, in that poem, trying to put yourself in somebody else's shoes.
Very much. It's good for me. It's good. I think it's good for the being to have to stretch and wiggle around like that. And compassion helps, but you know, the imagination can take you a long way too. It's like I love that Walt Whitman line of "Be plural like the universe," and that's what I hope to do in this particular collection.
If you think about it, plural and universe has uni in it. It's kind of an oxymoron.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, Whitman contradicted himself all the time.
I know. Well, we use that word. It's the only word we've got. Should be multiverse or something.
Yes, it should be. We'll have to work on that.
Dictionary writers out there. The book is divided, the book of poetry is divided into various sections. Psyche, things that want to be counted, new math, and you'll have to pronounce the last one for us.
Cheekshalub.
What is that last word?
It's the name of a meteor that struck the Earth around the Yucatan Peninsula. I mean, scientists have put this together, and it really decimated the dinosaurs about 60 million years ago.
That's the meteor that killed the dinosaurs?
Well, they think so. It may have. Hard to say, yeah. You know, but probably.
Why did you use that image for this section of poems?
It's, again, the name of a title of a poem that has many parts to it, including starting with the impact of the meteor on the Earth and then moving to people jumping off the World Trade Towers, to the human relationship with the Earth in many different contexts. And so the meteor, the scientists call that a meteor of that magnitude and a civilization ender. So it felt like it was big. It's important. And I'm not trying to say that the civilization is about to come to an end. I'm not an apocalyptic writer or thinker, but I'm just wanting the Earth to loom large in our universe and in our worldview.
Would you like to read another poem?
Sure. So I'll progress to the part of the book that's more about the collective unconscious. This one is called Barrel of Night. The way wild salmon power up laddered falls, drop their pearls in gravel and slide downward, or parrots swivel squawking heads on top of their bright bodies. Other species do not distress themselves, with certain exceptions, for instance, a modern dancer spiraling out of contraction. Human beings are doomed to review the conditions: good, evil, boredom, dread, freedom, commitment. Who am I? Where am I going? Each decision a fist of dirt gathering into a landslide. Who doesn't lie awake in the steel barrel of night, struggling to get things right? The vet on the radio, recently back from Iraq, terrified in his other mind, he'll lunge at the baby, cut off her fingers, whatever else he will do. His mind a pit mine, scraped bald, fogged in paranoia. He comes around wrapped in bars or a straitjacket, more than ever afraid of himself. Certain trails are treacherous to go back over. Who can foresee quicksand traps in a clear stream? A false step you take at 20 that lasts as many years, the one where a child slips underwater. We cling to the lines, the spinning compass, teased by sirens calling our secret names.
Anne Valley Fox. The book is called, the book of poetry is called How Shadows Are Bundled. I want to ask you a question, and I'll preface it by saying that I'm not suggesting, although many people do this and it's fine or whatever, that poetry or writing is in itself a therapeutic process. But what does the writing of poetry do for you, do for the poet?
There's a character in an E.M. Forrester novel that says, well, I write so that I know what I think. And that's always been the case with me. Not only what I think, but who I am, what I feel, how to make sense of things. You start out writing a poem or anything, really, other than a thesis. You start out with something, and you follow it along, and you find where it goes. And the poem starts to make sense of things for you. And to me, that's tremendously important. I can't bear the... You know, it's difficult to bear life without any synthesis or without any meaning. That thing that John Keats talked about, the negative capability to exist in, the person who can exist in mystery and doubt and uncertainty without the irrational, the irritable reaching after fact and reason. It's difficult, I think, for modern people to live in a world with so many contradictions and so much terror and violence and destruction and pain and suffering. And this is my means for sort of touching it all and kind of turning it over and making it my own experience without holding on to it. The poem then is an expression, and it's something that goes out beyond you, so it's not stuck within oneself.
There is a process of completing a poem that I'm sure you know very well, and it's great ups and downs, and I imagine some of them are completed quickly and some of them you labor over for a really long time. You just talked about this letting go of the poem. What is, and how do you know when it's done? I would imagine that it's being done is that which allows you to let go of not only the poem, but the mass of feeling that the poem is about.
Yeah. I know if I can read it out loud to you, and there's not a word or a line or a line break or a metaphor or any piece of it that says, ouch, oh no, that's not right. The poem has to release me. It has to say, okay, I'm ready to settle. Even if there are places in it that are bumpy or not perfect, that's not the same as being finished. Anyway, the poem tells me when it's finished. And it's mostly when it stops giving me trouble.
Ah. You know. What is it like when it is giving you trouble? What is that process or interaction like?
It's trying to find a way to say something, the words, maybe sometimes it's just one word, it could be an idea. The one that I mentioned, the notes to a man who was thinking of leaving his wife, both, that poem took me about 2 years, because I had a conclusion, I had something I wanted to say, I had one reason why this was not such a good idea. And I thought it was a beautiful reason, and I worked really hard to come up with it. And I stuck it on the bottom of at the end of the poem, and a couple of friends, critiqued the poem for me and said, it sounds moralistic, it sounds judgmental, it's not working. And I was so disappointed, because I really liked that ending. But finally I realized that ending was wrong, and I couldn't have it. I wasn't going to be allowed to have that ending. So once I threw it out, I found another ending which felt better and worked better, and the whole poem sort of slinked into itself.
Did you give the poem to the man?
I did.
And?
And he's out of town. We haven't actually talked about it, but I know it's all right. Yeah.
Anne Valley Fox is the author of the new book, How Shadows Are Bundled, with a foreword by the poet V.B. Price. It's published by the University of New Mexico Press, And once again, she will be this weekend, Sunday, November 29th, at the Acequia Booksellers on 4th Street in Albuquerque. It's wonderful having you with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Maybe we have time for one more quick poem.
I'm going to read to you Mad Elephants. I wrote it immediately after 9/11 when I remember feeling a sense of doom about how the U.S. was going to respond to the attacks on our land, which then became, took up that rather sinister term from another era, homeland.
Right.
And your listeners may remember how soon after that, President George Bush went into a huddle with some generals and military advisors to see how we were going to retaliate. And this poem reflects, you know, my personal concern about what kind of strategy they were going to come up with. And of course, now there are deliberations going on the same topic about war in Afghanistan. And although they seem to be more thoughtful and substantive than they were in 2001, the content of the poem is still chillingly appropriate. Mad Elephants, that has an epigraph from a little book by Lama Yeshe called Make Your Mind an Ocean. He said, "It is so worthwhile that you devote your precious human life to controlling your mad elephant mind." Mad Elephants. Under guard at Camp David, metal-chested generals, purple hearts, and scrubbed hands are locked in private council with the president. Big brass and enfant terrible, their own prodigal son. Out the window, rain strafes the open faces of 8 coral roses. I've muffled the phone and gagged the Sunday paper. Half the world will fall to its knees as we bomb the land of Afghanistan with mad elephants.
And Valley Fox, thanks again.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Jazz a la Carta.